Welcome again to Crown Encroacher. I am your host, Patrick Brown. In this episode, we turn attention to one of the greatest statesmen in Canadian history. Thomas Darcy McGee was a father of Canadian Confederation, a champion of minority rights, and the principal architect of the unique constitutional protections afforded to Catholic schools in Canadian provinces. Protections which are arguably unprecedented and unrivaled among Western democratic nations. Although overlooked in the history books of the Great White North, McGee exerted enormous influence on the founding of Canada, and as we'll discover over the course of this conversation, has many things to teach us in a present-day context defined by polarized political debates. Sadly, one of those lessons stems from the untimely death he encountered, courtesy of an assassin's bullet. Our guest is Dr. David Wilson of the History Department and Celtic Studies Program at the University of Toronto. Wilson is the author of the two-volume authoritative biography of Darcy McGee, which won the Canadian Historical Association Prize for Political History. His fields of expertise include the Irish in North America, revolutionary movements, as well as religion and nationalism. Be sure to subscribe to Crown Encroacher wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on anything related to church, state, and faithful citizenship. Thank you so much for listening in.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, but God's first.
Dr. David Wilson, welcome to Crown Encroacher. Great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Well, I'm excited. This is another segment in our recurring feature in which we look at statesmen over the years and over the decades and the centuries who profess the Catholic faith, whose faith informed their political worldview, and who don't always get the love or the attention that arguably they merit in the annals of history. So for today, we're looking at what Canadians might consider one of our native founders and fathers of Confederation, but in classic Canadian style, was an individual who we imported from overseas. We're looking at Thomas Darcy McGee and examining his life and legacy and perhaps what should be his proper place in the history books in Canada. So hoping to do a little bit of an exploration and perhaps a reclamation in that regard. So why don't we get right into it? I mean, you wrote the authoritative biography of Thomas Darcy McGee, two-volume work. To kick us off, I'd like to ask, why should Canadians care about Thomas Darcy McGee?
Well, first of all, I think Canadians have to realize that they are dealing with one of the most remarkable people in the country's history. The youngest and most intellectually gifted of the fathers of Canadian Confederation. And consider a thumbnail sketch of his track record. He wrote a dozen books, delivered hundreds of parliamentary speeches, composed over 300 poems, delivered well over 1,000 lectures, wrote innumerable newspaper articles, all while working as an editor and a politician, and indeed getting a law degree from McGill in the process. And all of this before his assassination a week short of his 43rd birthday. So we are dealing with a truly remarkable individual. And then if we pull the lens back a bit and consider the context, Darcy McGee at various stages in his life was a constitutional Irish nationalist, a revolutionary Irish nationalist, an ultramontane Catholic in the United States, a reform liberal in Canada, and finally a conservative in Canada. So his career can tell us a great deal about the three countries in which he lived and the formation of those countries, Ireland and the United States and Canada, where he was very influential indeed, particularly in Ireland and in Canada. Less so in the United States, but still a major figure among Irish Americans and within the Catholic Church.
And as we're wont to do in Canada, some would suggest that we don't preserve and celebrate our history as well as we could, but setting aside that rabbit hole, Thomas Darcy McGee, nevertheless, he's not really a household name in Canada. other figures, Johnny McDonald, Wilfrid Laurier, other titans from our history kind of loom larger in the historical consciousness. The first time I heard about him was after moving to Ottawa, and I happened to have a job on the same street where he was assassinated, and there's a bar across from the site that's named in his honor. How did Darcy McGee first come to your attention?
That's a very good question. Actually, I'll take that back a long time. So I was a graduate student at Queen's University, and I was about to do my PhD comprehensive exams. And I decided to come to Toronto and visit my brother, who was living here, and attend a conference put on by the Celtic Studies Program at the University of Toronto, Canada and the Celtic Consciousness. And I knew very little about Canadian history at this stage. My graduate work was in another area altogether. And it became very clear to me very quickly that this man I'd never heard of, Thomas Darcy McGee, was assuming mythical, legendary proportions among the organizers of the conference. Someone who had supposedly single-handedly saved Canada from the Fenians or Irish revolutionaries. Someone who was more responsible for Canadian Confederation than anyone else. And, you know, I could sort of smell the exaggeration very well. At the same time, though, this was during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And one of the speakers, a man named Conor Cruise O'Brien, very well-known Irish politician and journalist and writer, gave a talk on the Irish nationalist tradition and mentioned Thomas Darcy McGee in the process of this talk. It also became clear to me that in some senses, Conor Cruise O'Brien and Thomas Darcy McGee were kindred spirits, and that both of them, in different times, in different contexts, took on Irish revolutionaries who were involved in campaigns of violence. So I thought this is very interesting. And Conor Cruise O'Brien raised a glass to Thomas Darcy McGee and said a biography of him was long overdue. And I thought, file that one away, Wilson. And maybe one day you might have a crack at that. And it turned out to be many years later, after many twists and turns in my career, that I decided to move into Irish-Canadian history. And Thomas Darcy McGee was a natural choice. And the more I got into the story of Darcy McGee, the more fascinating it became.
Well, let's get into that story right now. He's born in 1825 in Ireland. Tell us about his childhood, his upbringing, and him as an adolescent and as a young man, that early period of his life and formation.
Sure. He was born in Carlingford, which is in the east coast of Ireland between Belfast and Dublin. And his father was working in customs. They moved around a bit. You know, he moved up to County Antrim, a beautiful place called Cushendall. In fact, he wrote his first novel about Cushendall when he was 17, I think. And then Wexford in the south of Ireland. And, you know, he was very, very attracted to two political movements in Ireland. One was Daniel O'Connell's campaign for repeal of the Union. That would give Ireland some degree of independence from Britain along the same lines that Canada was still part of the British Empire, but had a considerable degree of autonomy. And the other thing he was attracted to, I suppose, wasn't so much political as social, and that was Father Matthew's temperance movement, which was closely allied with Irish nationalist sentiment. You know, Ireland sober is Ireland free was one of the slogans. I was able to track down the first poem that he wrote, and he was 14 years old, and it was published in a Wexford newspaper, and it espoused the cause of temperance, which was. You know, he took the pledge as a teenager, although he certainly did not live up to it later in life. I mean, his career consisted of serious drinking, even by the standards of the day, which were pretty low, and periods of total abstinence. He oscillated from one to the other. But in his teens, those were the things that attracted him: constitutional nationalism and temperance.
And may I ask, was there anything about his family life or his environment or those around him that would have influenced that gravitation on his part? I mean, what kind of household did he grow up in? Were his parents devout? Tell us more about that.
It's impossible to know whether his parents were devout or not. But what we do know is that his mother died when Darcy McGee was 8 years old, when they were actually moving down to Wexford. She died in a coach accident. And I think that had a devastating effect on him. And he remembered sitting on his mother's knee and, you know, learning about Irish history and legends and myths from his mother. And then his father remarried, and neither Darcy McGee nor his siblings liked the stepmother at all. So there were serious tensions in the family. And that's actually why he got out. He first left Ireland at the age of 17 to go to first Rhode Island and then Boston. And although he described himself as an exile, he was only an exile from a family that had a stepmother he didn't like. He was in no sense a political exile. But once he goes to the United States, he has a meteoric rise. His first speeches are temperance speeches, and he immediately attracts the attention of the Irish community in Boston, who are extremely impressed with his oratory. They invite him to do the July 4th speech when he's 17 years old. And it's a barn burner. And then he gets a job working for the Boston Pilot, which was the leading Irish Catholic newspaper in the United States. And within 2 years, at the age of 19, he becomes its editor. I mean, this is an absolutely meteoric rise, an extraordinary beginning to his career.
And just for benefit of context, in terms of his upbringing in Ireland, I think I can surmise and speculate as to what the situation would have been, but what's the relationship like with the masters in the United Kingdom, in England, with the British crown? I mean, does he grow up and have quick sense that he's in a place where everyone is under the thumb of the British? Or was it the type of upbringing or environment where everybody knew someone, or everybody locally in the Irish community knew someone who was mistreated by the British masters? What would the dynamic have been like in that regard?
Well, he certainly knew through one of his teachers and through talking to older men and older women, he certainly knew about the 1798 Rising, it's 27 years before he's born. But as a young boy, he hears stories about the Rising and the brutal suppression of that Rising. And that too, I think, is a major factor in his political makeup, if you like. At the same time, he doesn't subscribe to revolutionary nationalism himself at this stage. He believes that moral force is the way ahead. Constitutional pressures, and in that sense, he's a follower of Daniel O'Connell. I don't think at any stage you find, possibly with the exception of when he's in the United States, but at most stages of his life, you don't find very much hatred towards the British per se. You do find severe criticism and sometimes ferocious criticism of British governmental policies in Ireland. Ultimately, though, at this stage in his life, the kind of solution he's seeking for Ireland is for Ireland to stay within the British Empire, but to have internal control of its own affairs. And this was to be achieved through peaceful means, through moral pressure.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about his time in America. He's on this meteoric ascent. Seems like he can do no wrong. He's got a platform. He has a voice. So where does all that go as he heads into his 20s?
He's called back to Ireland by Irish nationalists. There's a new generation of Irish nationalists who are particularly interested in cultural nationalism. Their view is that a politically independent Ireland is all well and good, but it doesn't actually mean very much unless Ireland has its own unique culture. And you know, it's expressed through language, literature, poetry, appreciation of architecture, myths, and so on, songs. And so McGee is drawn back to Ireland, and he joins the Young Ireland movement and becomes very quickly establishes a reputation of one of Young Ireland's greatest orators. And believe me, there was a lot of competition for that role because there were some amazing orators within that movement. So he's in Ireland. He works for a while, actually, for a rival newspaper, the Freeman's Journal, as their parliamentary correspondent in Westminster. So he actually learns a lot about the way British parliamentary procedures work. And that will come in very handy later in life in Canada. But more immediately, Young Ireland at this stage is not a revolutionary organization, but it will become one. It will become radicalized in 1848 in the context of two events. And one, the immediate one, is a revolution in France in February of 1848, which then triggers a whole series of revolutions in Europe. And if that can happen in Europe, why not in Ireland? Because Ireland, in Young Ireland's view, is far more oppressed than small nations in Europe. And the immediate context for that is the other event, if that's the right word, that's happening, and that's the famine. The potato fails in October of 1845. About a third of the Irish population are totally dependent on the potato. I mean, the average potato consumption per male in Ireland in the 1840s was 15 pounds a day. 15 pounds a day.
Wow.
Buttermilk was the diet. So once the potato fails, and it gets really bad in 1846, and 1847 is even worse, the consequences are catastrophic in Ireland. I mean, over this period, 1 million people will emigrate, and another million will die of hunger and mainly disease. Darcy McGee, by 1851, will double the number of deaths in his speeches and accuse the British government of, quote, 2 million ministerial murders, unquote. He did not hold back. Now, under these circumstances, these desperate circumstances, the French Revolution of 1848 seemed to offer a way out. You know, if only Ireland could get control of its own destiny, then the famine could be tackled. There was severe criticism of the way the British government was responding to the famine, and severe criticism of the relief programs that the British government implemented. So under these circumstances, McGee moves to a radical position, indeed a revolutionary Republican position. And you know, the age of 23, this is where he's at. He has become a Republican revolutionary. Now, this is particularly interesting in the light of the Catholic Church's response to the rising, to the revolutionary movement of 1848. The Catholic Church in Ireland is opposed to a revolution on the grounds that it would be impossible to succeed. Sort of classic, if you like, Catholic approach to justified war. There must be the possibility of success, and the Catholic Church, the hierarchy, argued this was not the case. McGee's position was that the reason the rising of 1848, when it took place, failed was precisely because the Catholic Church said it would fail and deterred people from joining the revolution. So he actually, to say he's anti-clerical would be an overstatement, but he's extremely critical of the Catholic Church at this stage. He says, you know, you can be a good Catholic, but also have independent judgment. You know, you can have your own opinions, your own politics. You can control the education of your children. And if you can't separate the politician from the priest, he said, then the logic is that you'll be governed by priests, and theocracy, not democracy, is the most perfect form of human government. And he rejects that. So when he crosses over, this time as a real exile, with a warrant for his arrest out of a reward being offered for his capture. He gets across the Atlantic, back to the United States, starts up his own newspaper in New York, and immediately falls foul of the Catholic bishop in New York, John Hughes, who denounces McGee as a dangerous and destructive influence, who bans his newspaper from parish reading rooms, describes his writings as, quote, sources of eternal damnation to all concerned, and describes him as that worst of Catholics, a, quote, Protestant Catholic, unquote.
Sorry, I just want to jump in here. So there's the uprising in 1848 in Ireland. Was it countrywide? Was it grassroots uprising? Or was it just kind of a pockets of some malcontents who grabbed their proverbial pitchforks? And I mean, how long did it last?
It was very quickly beaten.
Right.
It was a kind of a desperate throw of the dice after our habeas corpus had already been suspended. And it was as much a gesture of defiance. It was highly localized. McGee played a part in that revolution. He was in the northwest of Ireland, trying to link up with agrarian secret societies to galvanize the movement, and he failed in that. The secret societies wouldn't move unless other secret societies moved, unless they knew they weren't going to be isolated, cut off, and defeated, and the secret societies had nothing to do with it. You know, this young 23-year-old from Dublin coming up and trying to organize these seasoned agrarian in many cases, terrorists, actually, you know, who would do anything they could to hold on to their land, including maiming cattle, if necessary, killing people. These would be hard-bitten individuals that he would have been dealing with. The revolution was very, very, very quickly defeated, very swiftly defeated.
So he's a part of it. He's seen as a participant, if not an organizer, and he has to escape across the Atlantic, as you say, this time as a real exile. And he makes his way back to the United States. So what's his second trip and his second time of residence in the United States like? Where does that take him?
Well, yeah, he starts off in New York, and as I say, he was sort of breathing fire and brimstone against the British and against the Catholic Church. He had this newspaper, the New York Nation. He was sending copies of it back to Ireland because the radical revolutionary press had been suppressed in Ireland. So the idea was to, you know, use the United States as a platform from which to deliver the revolutionary gospel to the folks back home. But by this time, the revolutionary movement had been comprehensively defeated, and one of his closest friends and colleagues, and indeed a mentor, a leading Irish radical who would later turn constitutionalist, Charles Gavan Duffy, dissuaded him from continuing on this revolutionary course, saying, saying this to him, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, there are two conclusions you could draw from the failure of the 1848 rising. One is, okay, we've got to organize and do it right next time. And that was the path the Fenians would take a decade later. The other was to say, look, it's actually impossible for a revolution to succeed given the power imbalance between Britain and Ireland. As Darcy McGee himself would later put it, it would be like the clay pot dashing itself against the iron pot. The clay pot would just shatter, Britain being the iron pot, obviously. And once you take that position, which was McGee's position, he was persuaded, once you take that position, that then revolutionary nationalism becomes counterproductive. It will actually get in the way of the kind of gradualist reforms that you need to improve the situation in Ireland. You need land reforms. You need tenant reform. You need the disestablishment of the Irish Church, the Anglican Church in Ireland. You need religious equality in Ireland. You need to lift people out of poverty. You've got to find practical ways of improving the economy. And so that's the pragmatic position that he takes. And in taking that, he loses his revolutionary friends, most of whom regard him as a turncoat. won't be the last time he's accused of doing that, and allies himself with returns in a sense to constitutional nationalism. So one of the things this means is that that his animosity towards the Catholic Church for standing up against the rising begins to fade. The degree of anti-Catholicism that he expressed is now diminished. I think that's a very significant factor as we move ahead with the story of McGee in the United States.
So he doesn't stay in the U.S. forever. How does he keep himself occupied? And when did the seeds start to plant with him of, you know, looking across the border north to British North America, and what would ultimately entice him there?
Good question. And I think to answer it properly, we need to spend a bit of time in the United States, because it's not a very well-known part of his career, but I think it's absolutely fundamental to everything that follows. So he starts off in the United States as this sort of fire-breathing radical Republican who is opposed to the Catholic Church. And he winds up in the United States as an ultramontane Catholic and one of the most conservative Catholics on the continent, which is a remarkable transformation. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, how did that happen? And secondly, how did that affect his views towards Canada?
And sorry to interrupt, but just for clarification, it's not always widely known, but the label ultramontane, I mean, my understanding is that's someone who shows a high degree of obedience to the Pope, but not just in matters of religion, but also in the civil or the temporal realm. Is that correct?
Exactly. And that's where McGee goes. He becomes in an increasingly untenable position in the United States. He moves to Boston because Bishop John Hughes has basically killed his newspaper in New York. He starts up a new newspaper called the American Celt in Boston, and it's actually funded by financially backed by Protestants who admire him for taking on the most important Irish Catholic bishop in the United States. But at the same time, and this is in the context of this massive emigration from Ireland, which is overwhelmingly Catholic, like 80% Catholic, this migration stimulates a nativist, sort of anti-immigrant and indeed anti-Catholic backlash in the United States. So you find, not only American Protestant liberals with whom McGee was kind of politically aligned, you find not only them viewing the Catholic Church as a threat to American liberty, but you also find American nativists and indeed Irish Protestant immigrants making common cause against Catholicism in general and Irish Catholicism in particular. And in Britain, I won't go into the details of this, but in Britain, there's evidence gathering that anti-Catholic positions are being taken by the government. And McGee becomes convinced that Anglo-American Protestants are waging an undeclared but very real war against Irish Catholic Celts. So he's in a very, very difficult position because he's in a newspaper that is being funded by Protestant liberals. And the tensions within his position become greater and greater. And finally, in 1851, 3 years after his return to the United States, the tensions snap. And he has this remarkable conversion experience. He was a Catholic before, but this takes him from a liberal Catholic to a conservative Catholic. So you might recall I mentioned earlier he'd said a government by priests would be a theocracy, would lead to theocracy rather than democracy, and you can't have that. He accepts the logic and now embraces the outcome. He believes that a theocracy is indeed the best form of government. But of course, in the United States, you can't have a theocracy because of the political environment that you're in, nor can you have it in Canada, for that matter. We'll come to that, though. But so instead, McGee's position in the United States becomes something along these lines. The Catholic Church has a role in combating private judgment and the consequences of Protestantism. And in McGee's view, the consequences of Protestantism and private judgment are basically moral and social chaos. And, you know, he looks around the United States. His critique of American society is fascinating and instructive. He says the country, and this is in the 1850s now, he says the country is gripped by a sense of nervous excitement, which just latches on to one thing after another. It could be a Swedish nightingale, Jenny Lind, the singer, or it could be Catholic bashing, or whatever the latest trend is. There's a breakdown of the family, and he sees this in American slums, you know, particularly in the Irish communities. He sees prejudice. He sees proselytizing. He sees exploitation, degradation, squalor, violence, guns on the streets, corruption, materialism. All of this, he pins the blame for all of this on Protestantism and private judgment, and believes that the Catholic Church now has a role of combating this, of combating the morally degrading aspects of the United States and improving its moral and social culture.
He's in America in the 1850s. Did he have anything to say about the system of slavery in the country?
Yes, very good question. He did. And like many young Irelanders before him, he was ambivalent about slavery. He did not support slavery, but nor did he condemn it, because to condemn it, in his view, would be to weaken the American Union, and to weaken the American Union would be to strengthen Britain in its rivalry with the United States. And indeed make life harder for the Irish as Britain becomes stronger. You know, the Irish become even weaker, relatively speaking. So national unity trumped abolitionism for McGee until he comes to Canada. Because in Canada, you don't have the same kind of tension. You can be anti-slavery without believing or fearing that an anti-slavery position is going to tear the country apart. So in Canada, his anti-slavery position comes right out into the open. There's no longer any tension there. But in the United States, it has to be said, he supported the Fugitive Slave Bill, for example, in the interests of national unity. So unity came first. The plight of slaves or enslaved people was a distant second.
Was there a single point or a development that prompted him to visit or to move to Canada, or was it kind of a gradual progression of, as you say, the tensions that he was enduring?
A bit of both. What actually attracted him to Canada was the potential of the country as a refuge for Irish Americans from the sort of moral corruption and economic squalor of American life as he saw it. So in the mid-1850s, he starts to develop this plan, actually in league with some other Irish Catholics, some of whom are in Canada as well as the United States, to think about ways of getting impoverished Irish Catholic immigrants out of the ghettos, out of the city slums, into rural communities where they can be isolated, insulated from Protestantism and its corrupting effects. So Catholic, a sort of a Catholic colony or series of Catholic colonies within North America that will give Irish Catholic immigrants a much better life, in his view, than they currently were having, or many of them are currently having. So he develops this colonization scheme, and he looks north. He also looks west to the western part of the United States, but he looks north as a possible location and thinks about maybe the eastern townships would be a good place. Maybe there's room there, or maybe the Bruce Peninsula would be a good place. And he talks about bringing thousands of Irish Catholics into Canada, and actually becomes known as Moses McGee as part of this. And so he also runs into the opposition of Bishop John Hughes for that as well. But he goes ahead with the plan. That's what gives him contacts in Canada. The plan falls through, and indeed, as you would expect, there was severe opposition to it among Canadian Protestants who did not want Irish Catholics from the United States coming in large numbers, and made that abundantly clear. So it fell through, but it brought these connections with Canada, and the more he saw of Canada, even though it was part of the British Empire, and even though at this stage he was still very anti-British or anti-British against the British government, he thought Canada was different. As he said on one occasion, the British flag does indeed fly here, but it casts no shadow.
So where does he go when he first moves to Canada, and when does he first kind of get the political bug?
He never ever lost the political bug. He had it from the get-go, I think.
Sure, but in terms of seeking office or kind of doing more in that capacity.
Sure, he was originally intending to go to Ottawa, Ottawa or the Ottawa Valley, but probably Ottawa, and he had at that stage he had three children. Others had died, and one of those three children would die as well. But he wanted to make sure that they would be given a Catholic education, Montreal seemed to be a good place for that. He decided to go to Montreal, and a group of Irish Catholics in Montreal raised money for him to start his own newspaper. McGee had already made several trips northwards, already given talks, lecture series in Canada. So he knew his way around by this. Now 1857, he knew his way around. And he starts up this newspaper, which is called, appropriately enough, The New Era. And indeed, it was a new era in his own life. And he immediately outlines a program that becomes known as the New Nationality, which is a blueprint for Confederation. And what I find particularly interesting about this blueprint for Confederation is that it actually takes his constitutional nationalism from Ireland and transposes it to Canada while allowing for the differences in circumstances. So, Canada should have its own sort of national parliament, which is what he wants to handle its internal affairs while staying part of the British Empire, which is what he wanted for Ireland. Canada should have a railway system that will unite disparate provinces and foster unity. He'd wanted exactly the same thing for Ireland, railway development that would unite the country. Cultural nationalism, which was huge for him in Ireland, became equally important for him in Canada. The importance of establishing a unique Canadian culture that drew on the cultures of other countries and transformed them into something different, drawing on the best of American, British, French, Irish culture, and creating something distinctly Canadian. He also wanted economic protectionism for Canada. He wanted to protect Canada against the much more powerful economy of the United States, just as he had wanted to protect the Irish economy against the much more powerful economy of Britain. So I find this really interesting, that in a sense, Canada becomes a place where he believes he can fulfill the dreams that were dashed in Ireland.
And so where does all that take him, and how does he start to gain entry into decision-making circles and start to get to know the likes of John A. Macdonald and the provincial or the regional governments and their assemblies? Like, how does he get into that circle?
He runs for office in December of 1857, and he runs as an independent in Montreal. And he is elected. He has strong support from the Irish community. The parliament then is meeting in Toronto, and he goes down to Toronto for the parliamentary session of 1858. And the very first speech he delivers is a strong attack on the Orange Order in Canada, being sort of hyper-loyal and ultra-Protestant and anti-Catholic. And the Orange Order is growing in importance in Canada at this time. So he's highly critical of the Orange Order. He is opposed to John A. Macdonald. In fact, he points out John A. Macdonald himself is an Orange man. And McGee immediately is praised and criticized at different quarters for his speech. But this marks the beginning, really, of his political career. But he's got a problem as an independent. You know, he's not going to have very much influence. So he's got really two choices, and one is to join John A. Macdonald's Liberal Conservatives, but they're allied with the Orange Order, and you know, one of McGee's central goals is improved separate school legislation for Catholics in Canada West or Ontario. And John A. Macdonald talks a good game about that, but he never actually does anything. Then you've got George Brown and the Reform Party. And, you know, Brown had been a longstanding opponent of separate schools, so you don't seem to have very much room to move there. Brown had written that separate schools enclosed Catholic children in priestly establishments where no ray of light could enter their minds until it had been refracted by passing through a dense medium of bigotry and superstition.
Oh my God.
I mean, this was hardly someone he would want to ally with, right? But he did. He did. He decided that the best bet to get improved separate school education would actually be through George Brown rather than John A. Macdonald. And this was his reasoning. One day, George Brown is going to have to form a government. And the only way he can do that will be allying with French Canadians, French Canadian liberals. And the price of that alliance is going to be some movement on separate schools, some flexibility on separate schools. And indeed, to a degree, McGee was correct about that, to a degree, because Brown was willing to compromise to some extent. But you can imagine the backlash against this that McGee faced, particularly within the Catholic Church. I mean, Bishop Bourget in Montreal took the lead and used George Clark, the editor of the Catholic True Witness, as his attack dog. And believe me, McGee was attacked. And Clark is writing these editorials in which he calls George Brown and the Protestantism as the common sewer of the church. George Clark from in the True Witness just has diatribe after diatribe about Protestant bigotry, about George Brown, about brothels and gambling houses being the products of Protestantism. Catholicism is God's true religion. Anything that contradicted God came from the devil. Protestantism contradicted God. Therefore, Protestantism was a spawn of Satan. And this is the kind of thing George Clark was writing in attacking McGee's alliance with George Brown. And also, George Clark took Darcy McGee's earlier ultramontane writings and then used them against McGee for forming an alliance with George Brown. So this is fascinating. But it also indicates just how far McGee had traveled intellectually away from ultramontanism through a pragmatic need to compromise. McGee encountering George Clark, and in a way countering the language that he had used earlier himself, said that this was intolerant language, this was inflammatory language, it was threatening to poison Protestant-Catholic relations in Canada. And it would be very harmful to Irish Catholics who just want to get on with their neighbors, their Protestant neighbors. So the alliance becomes extremely problematic. And in the end, although George Brown briefly moved towards compromise, in the end, in a long process, McGee gradually came to realize that he'd actually been backing the wrong horse, that Macdonald was actually much more likely to deliver improved separate school legislation than George Brown and the clear grits behind him, populist Protestant movement, were ever likely to deliver. So he this is one. It's not the only reason why he moves to MacDonald, but it is a very important one. If you want to understand the shifts and changes in McGee's political position in Canada, the ball to keep your eye on is improved separate school legislation, because that was really, really important for him.
Fast forwarding to 1867, or the lead up to 1867, can you spend a few minutes talking about McGee's role in the Confederation debates and the formation of the Dominion of Canada, and the influence that he exerted, and the types of issues that he brought to bear in those discussions? I mean, it sounds like separate schools was key in that regard, but speak to that a little bit more if you could.
Certainly. As I've mentioned, he was a brilliant orator, and he applied that brilliance to the cause of Confederation. And he was by far, I think, the most articulate proponent of Confederation, because he couched Confederation in terms not simply of, you know, railways and federal provincial relations, but in terms of a vision of a country that could balance order and liberty, a country where minority rights would be respected, a country in which generosity of spirit, decency, kindness could be brought to the fore, a country that would be welcoming of immigrants who would themselves be encouraged to bring out the best in themselves to create a new kind of political environment, as well as a new kind of culture. And, you know, in some ways, in Ireland, his vision of Ireland's future had been grounded in history, Ireland's history. In Canada, it tended to be very much associated with geography, you know, with the beauty of the land and the capacity to create within this land a much more decent and sane society than existed in the United States, or indeed in Britain or in Ireland. But there was also a practical side to it. And, you know, in the sort of caricatured version of McGee, he's a poet and a dreamer and a speaker, but he's not actually very practical. He was extremely practical. Not only in all the committees that he was involved in and the detailed work that he did that, you know, didn't really make the headlines, but also in some practical issues like helping to bring the Maritimes on board to support Confederation, you know, organizing a trip with journalists and businessmen from Central Canada to the Maritimes, sort of a goodwill fest, if you like. It was described by one acrimonious critic as the big intercolonial drunk, and there was a lot of drinking going on as well. And that did help to pave the way for the Charlottetown Conference of 1864, where it was said Confederation was floated in on a sea of champagne. But the key meeting was in Quebec in the same year, the Quebec Conference of 1864. And I was rather surprised when I read the minutes of the debates over the not the political debates, but the minutes of the meetings at Quebec in 1864, because McGee is hardly there. It is indeed MacDonald and Cartier and Galt and to some extent Brown who are running the show. But there's one crucial intervention that McGee makes, and that is, of course, on separate schools. And he proposes an amendment which is carried without any controversy, that existing educational legislation in Canada West and Canada East, so Ontario and Quebec, would be carried over and enshrined in the new constitution for the new Confederation. And I think actually in his career, that was a thing that he was most proud of. And I brought in for our discussion a quotation to that effect. It's fairly short, but I'll just read it to you. "So far as I know, this is the first constitution ever given to a mixed people in which the conscientious rights of the minority are made a subject of formal guarantee. I shall never cease to remember with pleasure that I was the first proposer of that guarantee in the Quebec Conference, a guarantee by which we have carried the principle of equal and reciprocal toleration a step farther in Canada than it has yet been carried in any other free government, American or European."
So it's really not exaggerating or putting too fine a point on it to say the unique constitutional protections and treatment of denominational schools, Catholic schools here in Canada across the provinces, that legacy and that model is attributable to McGee.
That's right. I don't think that's an exaggeration. You might say for the Maritimes it was a different story because it was Central Canada that he got this for. And indeed, one reason why I think he was excluded from the delegation that went to Britain to seal Confederation was the fear that he might try to extend this to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. But for Central Canada, that is certainly true.
So as you say, he did play an essential role in helping to shepherd the agreement around Confederation and the establishment of the Dominion of Canada and the four founding provinces. And that was July 1st, 1867, where that took effect. And within a year or so, he paid a price for that. Can you speak to that a little more? The final chapter of his life and how it all culminated?
Yes, indeed. So he's no longer in the cabinet. He's in the first Confederation government. He steps down. He's also been quite ill for a while as well. And he's planning to leave politics, although whether he would have done or not is another question. He was planning to leave politics to focus on his writing, on literature. He had a book of poems and planned. He had a novel that he'd just begun working on that he was going to continue with. He'd had major financial difficulties, especially when he couldn't go on speaking tours because of his illness. John A. Macdonald decided to give him a sinecure, a job in the patents office for $3,000 a year, very handsome salary for the time. And that was going to be his future. And what McGee had also done, what we haven't really spoken about very much today, was take on the Fenians in the United States and in Canada. And he took them on with passionate intensity. I mean, I entitled volume two of my biography, Darcy McGee, The Extreme Moderate. He fought against extremes, that is, extreme orangism and extreme nationalism, with a kind of totality of argument and feeling. And in the process, he made many, many enemies. And his main targets in the mid-1860s were the Fenians, particularly in the light of the Fenian raids in Canada. And also because he thought the Fenians were disastrous for Ireland as well as for Canada. And a group of freelance Fenians, a small group from Ottawa and Montreal, decided, particularly after an election campaign in 1867, which was hard fought, they decided that they were going to assassinate McGee. And the man who was, and this was not an authorized Fenian operation from New York. This was a freelance operation coming out of Ottawa and Montreal. And Patrick James Whelan, this is my reading of the situation. Patrick James Whelan was part of that. And in my assessment, Patrick James Whelan made three attempts with friends to assassinate McGee between 1867 and April of 1868. And I think each time he bottled out, because there's a huge difference between actually saying you're going to assassinate someone and then putting a bullet in the back of their head. And I think Patrick James Whelan, with a friend of his, on the night of April the 6th, April the 7th, 1868, came together with the intention of assassinating McGee. I think, and I can't prove this, but to me it's plausible given the state of the evidence. I think the other person took Whelan's gun, seeing Whelan might not go through with it, and shot McGee in the back of the head. It was basically an unauthorized Fenian hit. Patrick James Whelan always swore that he'd never pulled the trigger. He may have been telling the truth. We catch him in other lies, for sure. So he may not have been telling the truth, but I suspect in this case he probably was. But he was still have been found guilty as an accessory, for which the penalty was death by hanging. So he would have met the same fate. But he refused to say who the other person was. He said he would rather be hanged than go down in history as an informer. So McGee is assassinated. 80,000 people come out onto the streets of Montreal for his funeral a week later, which also happens to be his 43rd birthday. And McGee is instantly turned into a martyr for Canadian liberty. And a group called Canada First builds a Canadian nationalist group builds itself around D'Arcy McGee's program to try and keep the vision that he had alive. And McGee remains a prominent figure in Canadian discourse until round about the First World War. And by the 1920s, he's becoming increasingly forgotten. And as Canada changes, the Orange Order fades, new immigration occurs, new groups come in, Canada becomes increasingly secularized, McGee becomes increasingly forgotten. And one of the most fascinating and instructive and revealing chapters of Canadian history did not receive the attention that it deserved. Conor Cruz O'Brien was right back at that conference in 1978. McGee deserved a biography, and I tried to give him one.
Well, we appreciate your effort and your labor of love in making that happen. Just as we wrap up the conversation here, how do you reflect on McGee's legacy and his significance for contemporary Canada? I mean, some things that jump out for me, obviously his championing of minority rights and the rights of Catholics in British North America, and his fingerprints being over the very unique constitutional protections that Catholic schools enjoy in Canada. We hear a lot in Canadian discourse these days about reconciliation. And I can't help but think that, here is a figure who, in his own zigzag type of way, he demonstrated lessons around forgiveness, around building alliances, around enduring pain and suffering and mistreatment, but then moving on and looking to the future. Can you speak to that a little more?
I couldn't put it better myself. I agree with everything that you said. He once wrote that anyone can find justification when they're walking down the street to get other people to move out of the way, and that was not the way to live your life. We needed to approach life with generosity of spirit, with kindly feelings, that they should inform what we do. But we must also have the courage to stand up against those who would threaten an open, tolerant society in which people who differ with each other can accept those differences, respect those differences, and not batter each other over their heads with dogmas. And I think in the increasingly polarized world that we are living in, with extreme discourse, extreme views being expressed on the left and the right, I think it's a very important sort of message in an attempt to reclaim the middle ground, where respect, generosity of spirit, kindly feelings, tolerance, basic human decency have some space in which to breathe.
Well, you're the authoritative biographer of Mr. McGee. We mentioned earlier in the program, there's a bar on Spark Street in downtown Ottawa. There's also a federal government building in the vicinity named in his honor. What would you like to see Canadians or Canada do better in terms of commemorating this hero of theirs? What does he deserve beyond the very rich biography that you've penned? What does McGee deserve, and how do we get him to become a household name?
I think within the educational system, which is unfortunately downgrading history as it is, I think within the educational system, it would be important to recall individuals such as McGee. I'm thinking also of what's happening in Ireland right now, where McGee has also been forgotten. In fact, I would say McGee was forgotten more in Ireland than he has been in Canada, even though he was a really important figure in the Young Ireland movement. But in Ireland now, there's a Thomas D'Arcy McGee Summer School, which is basically summer school in Ireland, denoting a conference that's open to the general public. And it attracts politicians for all stripes. One of its principles is to bring in just about everybody. So you get, ultra-Protestants with ultra-nationalists coming together and forum. And maybe sometimes more heat than light is generated, but at least people are around the table and they're talking rather than shooting at each other. And I think that's a very positive development. And I think it would be great if something similar could happen on this side of the Atlantic, that there could be an annual conference that would attract everyone from the leader of the Conservative Party to the leader of the People's Party of Canada to the leader of the NDP to the leader of the Bloc Québécois to the leader of CAQ. Everybody around the table to try and talk things out and to search not for what divides them, but for common ground. That might be idealistic, it might be utopian, but something along those lines has been happening in Ireland. So it's not totally impossible.
Based on your description of that event in Ireland and everything we've talked about in terms of the life and legacy of McGee, I am reminded of the verse of blessed are the peacemakers, and perhaps that's one of his lasting legacies and lessons as well. Dr. David Wilson, I want to thank you so much for your time. Appreciate your insights. Appreciate your gift to us in terms of your work on McGee's life. I would commend it to all of our listeners, and I want to thank you for joining Crown and Crozier.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're enjoying Crown and Crozier, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd be grateful if you could help us reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. Also, we'd love to hear from you. Check out our website at crownandcrozier.com or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We're sincerely grateful for your support, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship.